Welcome to the Nevada Court of Appeals. I'm Michael Gibbons, the Chief Judge with Judge Jerry Tao today and Judge Bonnie Bulla. We're sitting on bunk. There's three of us and all three are here. But the big news is this is our first day back from the pandemic. So it's our third argument for the day for today. And it's been pretty exciting to be back in court with everyone. Of course, we were had a case on earlier where we were talking about the proceedings were all on BlueJeans, so it was remote and there were some issues related to it. So those cases will be working their way through the system. This case involves a foreign will. It's Christy K. Sweet versus Chris Hisgen or Hisgen. I'm not sure the pronunciation. Hisgen. Okay. Right, he's the respondent. This is through the pro bono program. So we have Ms. Carrie Kleiman representing the appellant, and you have co-counsel today.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Michael Fetter is with me from my office, and we also have two of our first years who just graduated from law school observing their first time in this wonderful building.
All right.
Natasha Sharma and Brady Gatt.
Well, welcome. Okay, and you made them sit in the audience?
Yeah, Brian.
All right, yeah, we got a couple more weeks to go on. Or no, what is it?
It's soon, yeah.
First week of October,
yeah,
I believe.
A couple weeks, yeah, maybe less.
Okay, hopefully some exciting news coming in a very positive way. Well, thank you for taking the case through the pro bono program. It's much appreciated. It's something like this is an unusual case involving a foreign will, so I don't know that it would get developed if we didn't have lawyers on the case. Okay, and we're also back to having people in our courtroom watching too, so that's exciting to see them and welcome everybody that's here today. Anything else you want to say, Judge Tao, before we start?
No, just to echo the chief's comments that thank you all for being here. It's you know, it's good to be back in person. I know it's been an impediment on everybody. I'm sure your practices were all deeply affected by the last couple of years, but we're, you know, moving forward now. And again, thank you for taking this pro bono. As you guys know, and this is also for the audience, but there's hundreds and maybe thousands more cases that need lawyers, and there are lawyers willing to step up. So it's always great to see people who are willing to devote some time to these cases, and especially appellate cases they tend to be pretty complex. There's lots of, you know, it's a big sacrifice of time, and we know that, we appreciate it. And for anyone else in the courtroom, you know, we'd encourage you to participate, because there are people who need lawyers and can't get them. And anything you guys can do to help, it helps the lawyers, it helps the litigants, it helps us in our decision making as well. So thank you again.
Thank you, Judge Bulla.
Welcome. We're so happy to see you all. One of the things about taking a pro bono case is sometimes you get to practice in an area that you never thought about. And that's fun and challenging. And sometimes the pro bono cases are fun and challenging even if you practice in that area. So we're really looking forward to the argument today, and thank you all for being here.
Right. Ms. Kleiman, then you would be going first.
Yes, sir.
Do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
3 minutes. Okay. All right. Please step forward, and we're happy to listen to you today.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I believe that the issue in front of us is mostly a legal issue, so I'm going to only spend a very brief amount of time going over the facts, unless Your Honors would prefer a more robust record. The facts of this case that we believe matter the most is the fact that the only testamentary document in question is a will that was executed in Portuguese, in Portugal, and in 2006. I don't speak Portuguese. I don't believe that anybody that has been on this case before then speaks Portuguese. We did have, however, two competing translations in the record, which have slightly different, and we believe those are material different, interpretations of the language used in this will. So our position today is primarily the legal issue, and there are three items that we would like Your Honors to consider. The first is that this will does not meet the requirements of an international will under NRS Chapter 133A. Because of that, we believe that it was improperly admitted in probate court, and so on that basis, we would ask that you reverse the decision below. The second issue goes to the various translations, and we believe that the plain language of the will, really under either translation, but especially under the one that was purportedly provided by the subscribing witness, who is also an attorney in Portugal, we believe that the grammar very clearly connotates that the will is only intended to address and deal with property that is located in Portugal. And therefore, it was reversible error to admit that will to probate in order to deal with the property, the real property at issue here in Nevada. Finally, we believe that at a minimum, this should be remanded for further proceedings because based on the record, we believe that there was sufficient information before the probate commissioner to trigger the requirement to have a will contest so that there would be some level of proof required rather than simply affidavits. So turning to the first issue, we believe that NRS 133A is very clear. It talks about certain requirements that an international will has, and the main ones that we're addressing today is the fact that there needs to be an authorized signatory, which there is not. There needs to be a signature of the testator on each page if they are going to have a will that's more than one page. The will in question here is two pages, and there was only a signature on the final page. And then finally, NRS 133A requires that there's a certificate of compliance signed by the authorized representative that says this is a valid international will. I don't think that there can be any real dispute that those items were not met here. And even if there were...
Ms. Kleinman, let's just for a moment say you were right about every one of those points. The court admitted the will to probate for two different reasons, both under the international law and under the normal.
Yes.
So are you challenging the other part of the district court's ruling?
Yes, Your Honor, we are. We don't believe that it is proper to admit the international will that is non-compliant with the international will statute under NRS 133. The reasoning given by the probate commissioner, we believe, was a gross oversimplification. What the commissioner said was essentially the only thing that an international will requires is that it be in writing and signed by the testator. With all due respect to the commissioner, there wouldn't be an entire chapter of the Nevada Revised Statutes if that were true. The legislative intent in creating Chapter 133A is very clear that wills made internationally that are intended to apply to property in Nevada or anywhere else need to comply with this statute.
All right. So you didn't outline that as one of your three arguments, so I just wanted to make sure you're still arguing that point.
I appreciate that, Your Honor.
I didn't want you to have to suddenly switch gears and go to that, but you have. But if you want to go back to your original order, that's fine, too.
Your Honor, I think that they're really one and the same, because certainly if it did meet the qualifications under 133A, we wouldn't have as much of an argument as we are trying to make, to be quite frank. But because it doesn't, we believe that it's also improper to take a will that is non-compliant with 133A and then get it in under 133. The beginning portions of NRS 133.080 says, except as otherwise provided for in NRS 133A. I believe that the plain language of that makes it very clear that the legislature was saying, this applies to every will that is not otherwise covered under 133A. If they had wanted for the provisions of NRS 133 to also attach to wills made internationally under 133A, they could have said something else, like notwithstanding anything to the contrary in NRS 133A. Because they didn't do that, I think that it was an overstep and an error of law for the courts below to admit this will under either NRS 133A, which it was not compliant with, or 133.
Did you look at the legislative history?
Yes, Your Honor, briefly. And I do not have that in front of me, but it does talk about having the desire to have the wills probated internationally all be uniform. And that's why they have these requirements.
Okay. All right, going back to your first point about the international will, and the signatures. Doesn't Nevada law allow for wills to still be valid even when they're not signed on every page?
Yes, Your Honor. Nevada law does when you're dealing with wills that are made in Nevada. When they are made internationally, then the requirements of NRS 133A we present would be what controls. And 133A does expressly say that when there is more than one page to a will, it needs to have a signature by the testator on every page.
Are there any exceptions to that?
Not in the plain language of the legislature.
Okay. All right, what about an authorized person? Who is that?
Well, that is a bit more of a question. The Nevada statute refers primarily to persons in Nevada, which gives the impression that, you know, if you wanted to, and this argument was made below, if you wanted to essentially make an international will that was non-compliant, but made overseas compliant with NRS 133A, you could have a member of the Nevada bar sign it and sign this certificate of compliance. You could have a foreign affairs counselor, someone from the embassy overseas, sign it there. Or there could be somebody who is under the law of that jurisdiction, recognized as an authorized signatory, sign and then sign the certificate of compliance.
So that's the person in Portugal.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, we don't have enough of a record fleshed out to know who actually signed, who were these people. We have three affidavits that were provided after the initial petition and after the initial opposition to the petition. They might be from two different people. They might be from three different people. There's two different names on one of them, but it seems like two of the people have slightly different names, but they're actually the same person. One is an attorney in Portugal. The other is signatory to the will, and they both have a name that involves Isabella Santos. One of them has, you know, Dr. Maria Isabella Santos, and the other is just Isabella Santos. Their signatures appear to be the same, and frankly, we don't know. The affidavits that were provided to the courts below are signed under the statute that allows for, you know, there to be sworn statements that are made in Nevada. They clearly weren't. In the answering brief, respondent admits that these were people from Portugal. I don't have any other information, and quite frankly, neither do Your Honors, because the record is devoid on those points.
What did the district court do wrong then?
Well, the district court, I think, did a few things wrong. With all due respect to Judge Sturman, I love her, but I think she kind of missed the mark on this one a little bit. And part of that is because I think that she took a lot of Commissioner Yamashita's opinions into account. And one of those certainly is the preference to have the avoidance of intestacy. I understand that there is a definite preference to give effect to a testamentary instrument when one exists. However, I think here, the testamentary instrument was intended, when it was made, to apply only to assets in Portugal. And I think that's made very clear by the language that gets used. Based on the different interpretations, regardless of which one this court looks at, the language used says either that the respondent was made the universal heir. I'm trying to find the exact language for Your Honors. It was either the universal heir to all of her goods, comma, rights, comma, and actions in Portugal. That was translation number one. Translation number two says that the respondent would be established as the universal heir to all of her assets, comma, rights, and shares in Portugal. I think under either of those, the plain English reading of that and the plain language reading of that is that in Portugal is intended to modify the entire clause. However, Commissioner Yamashita decided that it was only based on the first translation that it was actions in Portugal, but goods and rights located everywhere in the world. I think that's a bit of a stretch. I don't think that there is really any grammatical rule that would reasonably apply in order to make that determination. I think the more accurate and more reasonable reading of that is that it is goods in Portugal, rights in Portugal, or actions in Portugal. That's especially true when you look at the statement from the interpreter that was submitted along with that translation. In that, her own statement was that this will devises all of her goods in Portugal to respondent. That was completely glossed over by the commissioner, and in fact, he supported his decision by conducting his own research rather than doing something that I think would have been more appropriate, such as asking the parties to brief and to submit additional research and briefing on what a universal heir means. Instead of asking the parties to flesh out that record, the commissioner went and did his own research. We don't know where, we don't know to what extent, and he determined that based on that research, the universal heir was intended to mean that Mr. Hisgin would take all of the property anywhere in the world.
What do you think it means?
I think that the universal heir means something that we need to brief more, quite frankly. I mean, if we looked while writing this appeal, and I see that I'm at 3 minutes, but I would like to answer this question before I finish. You know, when we were researching this appellate brief, there's law that says that the universal heir concept is anathema to Portuguese law. Portugal does not permit parents to cut out their children. And I think because we're dealing internationally, we need to have the correct international law that we're looking at and the correct international definition, whereas the one that the commissioner relied upon was based on Ukrainian civil law, which might be very different than Portuguese. And so on that basis, we would ask that your honors, at a minimum, reverse this and allow for more proceedings. But we do think that there is sufficient information in the record for you to make a de novo ruling that the will only applies to property in Portugal. And I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we'll move ahead to the respondent. There were a lot of points covered in a short period of time there.
Well, I'll do my best. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Thomas Grover, 12387, on behalf of the respondent, Christopher Hisgin. Just by way of a roadmap, I want to talk about first the different paths towards admitting this will to probate that were developed by both the probate commissioner and the district court, because there are a number of ways the will can be admitted to probate. And as long as one of those is upheld before this court, the district court must be affirmed. And I think that's important because there's a distinction between NRS 133, which deals with wills generally, and NRS 133A, which deals with international wills. And this issue was anticipated within the international will statute that Nevada adopted. And it's right at the very beginning. It's in NRS 133A.050, subsection 2. The invalidity of a will as an instrument, as an international will, does not affect its formal validity as a will of another kind. In other words, straightforward, if a will does not qualify as an international will, it still might qualify as another type of will. And so that's how we get to 133. So whether the will is admitted under 133A properly or whether it was admitted under 133 properly, the district court was ultimately right. And I think some context here is important. This is a really a fascinating issue because it has an international component, but then here it also has a federalism component. The purpose of the international will statute in this Unidroit treaty was to allow for a seamless mechanism globally among the countries that adopted this for wills to be admitted to probate so that there weren't denials of admission based on technicalities. Now, the federalist component is interesting because whereas Portugal adopts this as a nation, in the United States, the federal government has no authority to deal with probate, so each state does this on their own. And so we have this statute, this act that allows for Nevada to participate in this international community. But this doesn't override Nevada's sovereignty or Nevada's law on admissions of wills to probate. And that's where we get into NRS 133. And specifically, we go to 133.080, and we start talking about foreign execution of wills, so wills that are executed outside of the state of Nevada. And there are two different ways a will executed outside the state of Nevada under subsection 1 can be properly admitted to probate in Nevada. One of those is where the will is valid under the jurisdiction where it was executed, in this case Portugal, or two, if it's valid under the domicile of the testator, in this case Maryland. And this is again a fascinating factual scenario because you have Chris and his significant other at the time, they eventually got married in Maryland, and they're in Portugal, but her residence is still Maryland. It says it right in the will. And so if we look at both of these subparts of requirements, whether Portuguese law or Maryland law, it was properly admitted into probate. Under Maryland law, they have a statute that is similar to ours that requires that a will be in writing, signed by the testator in the presence of two subscribing witnesses. That's the same as our requirement under NRS 133.040. And Portuguese law is satisfied as well. In the record, got the declaration of Isabel Santos, and she's the lawyer that assisted them with this, and she offered a sworn declaration that this meets the criteria because it was made voluntarily of her own free will, and it cites the Portuguese Civil Code 2179. And so whether we're looking at Portuguese law or we're looking at Maryland law, this will is properly admitted as a foreign will under NRS 133.080. And of course, the question is, Mr. Grover, what about this language at the beginning that has been briefed and now argued, which is, except as otherwise provided in Chapter 133A of NRS, doesn't that override and impose the International Will Act over NRS 133A080? And the answer is no, for two reasons. First, just a moment ago, we went over NRS 133A050, which explicitly says that failure to meet the requirements of an international will does not necessarily invalidate the will under other law. But then the other thing here is just the plain language of the statute. This does not say except as otherwise required by NRS 133A. It says except as otherwise provided by NRS 133A. And if you go and look at the briefing, and I know you have, where you look at the history of this international statute, both at the convention that was held in Washington, D.C. in 1973, and then as was later adopted and ratified by the Nevada legislature, the idea here was to provide additional mechanisms to admit wills to probate, not to restrict the ways by which wills are admitted to probate in any specific jurisdiction that adopts the treaty, whether it be Nevada or Portugal or some other jurisdiction around the world. In fact, the UNIDROIT website explicitly says the convention did not and has not attempted to revoke or override the laws of signatory nations. Nevada retains its sovereignty to have its own requirements and its own independent ways to admit wills to probate, which is found generally in NRS 133, and as to foreign wills, 133.080 specifically. And then as this was deliberated and debated by the Nevada legislature, Senator Kerr, in a committee meeting, noted, again, this is following the language of the statute that was eventually adopted, the invalidity of a will as an international will does not affect its formal validity as a will of another kind. Let us say that you do not observe some of the formalities. It may be that you have handwritten the will. You may be in a country where they recognize a holographic will, or somebody writes out a will and there's no witness. Just because it is not a valid as an international will does not necessarily mean that it would not be a valid will under the law of another jurisdiction. And so this issue about whether the international will statute in 133A would override Nevada's standard will statutes in NRS 133 was anticipated and deliberated by the Nevada legislature. And so when we're looking at NRS 133.080, there's two different ways to admit this. One's through Portuguese law, the other is through Maryland law, and the context of the statutes themselves anticipate that either way could be taken by a petitioning party seeking to admit a will to probate. Now let's talk about the public policy issue where we have obviously strong case law around the entire country that favors testacy over intestacy. And there are good reasons for that. Intestate statutes exist as a method of last resort to distribute an estate. They're what we think most people would probably want to do if they had made a decision. And so we give priority to spouses and then children, and we work our way out in the family tree. But where there's a document and it's otherwise valid and there are questions about interpretation of the document that are put before the court, public policy favors testacy over intestacy. And the context of this will in particular is helpful in interpreting whether or not the district court and the probate commissioner were correct to interpret this language as being a complete testacy over partial intestacy. And that's for first and foremost because there's a residuary clause that anticipates what would happen if Mr. Hisgen predeceased Marilyn, if Chris predeceased Marilyn. And that was she wanted the entire estate to go to her daughters. And if the appellant's argument were accepted, we would end up in a scenario where the distribution to Chris is narrow, but the residuary clause is large, which is an absurd result and mechanically really isn't feasible and possible. This document was clearly intended to dispose of all of the decedent's assets. Finally, I want to address the international will statute.
But before you move on, your last argument then intended to refute the argument that was just made about the two competing translations? Because one of them, you would have an intestacy situation and the other you wouldn't. So you take the presumption against intestacy and go with that.
Right. And the real difference between these two translations is the use of commas, and then in one it talks about actions in Portugal, and the other it talks about assets in Portugal. And so when we're applying the rule of the last antecedent, it's within the context of the public policy in favor of testacy. People don't create wills that have partial intestacy for the primary beneficiaries and then universal disposition for the residuaries in the case of the primary beneficiary predeceasing them. And so that is my answer. Whether we're talking about assets or actions, the analysis is the same.
Did you look for the definition of universal heir too?
I've dug in on this, and it appears that this is a common probate concept in civil law jurisdictions that goes back to Roman law. We, of course, are a common law country. And so the concept of universal heir is something we probably don't encounter very often here, if at all. I've been doing estate and trust litigation for over a decade, and this is my first time encountering it. But that's my understanding, is that it's a creation of civil law that traces back to Rome.
Okay, so moving on to the international will, is there a problem if all the pages aren't signed?
Well, this breaks down into looking at the statute here. 133A070 has additional requirements, and this is where the requirement is imposed to sign each sheet. And subsection 4 here is important, and it says a will executed in compliance with 133A060 is not valid merely because it does not comply with this section. And so the provisions of NRS 133070, while imposed on international statutes, are not fatal if they are not met by the terms of the statute itself. And so, obviously, as a matter of a factual matter, not every page is signed. But that doesn't matter because of subsection 4.
Okay. What about the authorized person?
Well, the definition of authorized person is expansive. It just says that it includes, then it lists diplomatic corps and some other people. And our position is that Isabel Santos, Maria Isabel Santos, as an admitted lawyer in Portugal, is a corollary to a Nevada attorney, and is therefore an authorized person.
Is that Isabel Santos the same as the other Isabel Santos with the longer name and a doctor in front of it?
I believe so, but I am not an expert in Portuguese naming conventions. And I don't speak Portuguese. I wish I did. Well, my brother does.
Let's put it this way. Is there anything from the record that would suggest it's not the same person?
I don't believe so.
So it sounds like you don't agree with any of the points that were raised by Ms. Kleiman.
I appreciate that they were articulated well and reasoned well and researched well, but there probably is disagreement on every legal issue that's been raised.
Okay, well, she also challenged the will contest but didn't have time to get into that. Is this simply a situation where the citation was not filed and therefore the statutory requirement was not met?
Well, I get to be a little bit of a veteran here because the case on point for this issue is the estate of Black. And this is a case that I handled very early in my legal career. We took it over where our client went in to contest a will. They filed the contest, but they failed to issue the citations within the time period. So everybody knew there was a contest. There was no dispute about that. And we took the case over for the appeal, and the court held that a citation is just like a summons in a civil matter. It's how the court acquires personal jurisdiction over the personal representative in the case. So it's not merely a matter of notice. It's a jurisdictional issue. And the failure to timely issue and serve citations under the estate of Black is fatal to a will contest. It's not a matter of notice or substantially complying. It's a jurisdictional issue, and it requires exact compliance. It's one of the scarier deadlines in trust and estate litigation to get those citations issued and served in a timely manner. And I've been in court when that's not happened, and some ugly results have happened. But they cite to this Black case.
All right. So this was with Commissioner Yamashita and Judge Sturman. Ms. Kleiman says that, hey, normally they're good, but in this case they made a mistake. Just in a couple words, is that accurate?
No, they're, except for our Court of Appeals in the state, they're the greatest legal minds available. But in all seriousness, this was briefed heavily. Uh-huh. And it was briefed thoroughly before the court. And there was extensive oral argument both before the commissioner and in front of Judge Sturman. And I do want to note that through that process, this issue about a will contest under Chapter 137 was never raised. And so that's being raised for the first time on appeal. I can appreciate you know, we come on appeal with the record we have, not the record we want. But it would be improper to seek reversal under 137, both because of the citation issue, but also because it wasn't raised below. It was never pled in any of the pleadings before the commissioner or the district court. To the extent that Christy felt that it should have been considered by the commissioner, there was an opportunity to raise that issue in front of Judge Sturman, but that didn't happen.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Grover.
Thanks.
So we went over time on that argument, so we'll add a little more time back into your argument. Back to 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. A few points that I must mention. Although there was substantial briefing down below, you'll notice that before Commissioner Yamashita made his own research, there was no briefing on the meaning of this universal heir provision. That was brought into the matter based on his extrajudicial research, which then was sort of regurgitated in front of Judge Sturman. So I think on that basis, there is an error of law because a judge is meant to rule on the record before them. If the litigants do not put forward that sort of information, then I don't believe that it's proper for the probate commissioner to go and find it on his own rather than asking for supplemental briefing.
Well, was there an objection? There obviously was time.
There was in the original hearing, the appellant's counsel did mention, you know, Your Honor, we haven't had a chance to brief this. And although it wasn't stated as directly as I think an objection ideally would be, I think there was enough there for the commissioner to know that the appellant's counsel was not in agreement with the fact that there had been this research conducted. I think going to the main issue is, at the end of the day, even if Your Honors disagree with our interpretation of NRS 133A, which we believe is meant to apply, and the provision that opposing counsel mentioned is meant to apply to a will that is written in Nevada to deal with outside assets. Here, the United States in Nevada is the foreign country. You know, we do not have a record before us that goes into Portuguese law, and whether there's a comparable Portuguese statute that says, even if you don't have a proper international will, it's still valid here. You know, that is part of why we believe that the Portuguese will, which says that it applies to actions or shares in Portugal, refers to having everything in Portugal. You know, the different language is not the difference between assets and actions. I think that would be a closer call. The different language is that one says goods, rights, and actions, and the other says assets, rights, and shares. The shares is something that I think it's a lot harder to say, well, shares in Portugal make sense, and then everything else.
Right, but what do we do with the fact that a particular translation was used and nobody developed a record to show, well, shouldn't have used that one, should have used this other one?
I think that the answer then is for you to remand for further proceedings. I think the record was not properly developed.
But shouldn't that be demanded at the time and not on appeal?
I think there are plenty of cases where by the time we get to appeal, there are, you know, factual developments that weren't fleshed out that the appellate court can't make a decision on because they can only rule on the record. And so it gets remanded for further proceedings and for further factual development.
Okay. I did bring up the point about the citation, and you heard the argument that Mr. Grover made, which was in the overtime session. Do you want to respond to that?
If you can remind me exactly of which question.
He's essentially saying that if you don't file the citation, it's jurisdictional and you can't have a will contest.
Your Honor, I mean, this is not the area of law that I practice in. I believe that in those circumstances, an in-estate versus Black or the estate of Black, that was dealing with people who weren't actively involved in the will. You know, here, I don't think that there was a lack of personal jurisdiction over the respondent who was the only other interested person. The other sibling of appellant had already essentially disclaimed anything, and she didn't want anything to do with the matter, and that's in the record. And so I think the jurisdictional argument falls a little flat here when the only person the court needed jurisdiction over is the person who was unequivocally there.
And his backup argument is that it wasn't raised below.
Which is valid. You know, I don't have a great answer to that other than I think that there are sufficient other problems with the record below that there's quite a few reasons why this should be at a minimum remanded for further proceedings.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kleiman, Mr. Grover, and for all of the other help you got, Ms. Kleiman, from your office. It's obvious you spent a lot of time on this, and it's much appreciated. Somebody takes a pro bono case and is willing to really dig into it, particularly when there's unusual issues like in this case, and it's outside your normal area of practice. And you're going to get somebody that it is his normal area of practice.
Situation, you know.
All right. Well, Judge Tao already expressed our admiration for this pro bono program, and we all strongly believe in that, and we hope you all will do that again. And also, even on your side, for Mr. Grover, I don't know if you've ever been involved in it, but it gives you the chance to spread your wings, so to speak, and look in other areas of the law. And even if you don't want to argue a case, if you can be a mentor in the program, you'd help people on probate cases.
I did ask for
Okay. All right. Any final comments from my colleagues?
Thank you all. It was very interesting. I was really engrossed in the argument, and I really enjoyed it. So thank you both.
Okay. Anything else, Judge Taylor?
No, just a really interesting case, really interesting questions of law here. Yeah, this is one of those statutes that, you know, I wouldn't want to be the probate commissioner because you have to interpret Nevada law, Maryland law, Portuguese law, and, you know, everybody did the best they could, but it's just one of those statutes that requires that to be done, and it's just the way these things are designed. But interesting case, great argument by both of you, and we'll consider it carefully.
Okay. All right. We'll be in recess, but I'm going to step down because I want to say hello to somebody in the audience.
Oh, okay.
Okay.